welcome to the Moonshine Jesus Show. We are back after a week off. We are back. We are here. As promised, we are revisiting the part two, Rebel Moon. We did part one. We had some pretty pointed feelings about part one, and we promised to do part two anyway. And so we're back doing Rebel Moon part two, The Scar Giver. And as always, as you've heard, I am joined by my good buddy Caleb. How you doing today, Caleb?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Mark. Even though we're talking about Rebel Moon Part 2, we're going to have a good time with this. I'm glad to be here with you. We always have a fun time when we're together.
Indeed. Absolutely. We're going to dig into this. First, we need to let people know and remind them that we are sponsored by ProgressiveChristianity.org, a fantastic place for all of your progressive Christian needs. All kinds of resources there. Please go check them out, as well as the Moonshine Jesus Show. Follow us on Facebook. Make sure that you are downloading us at wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. And we do need to remind you, as always, this is a spoiler-full zone. We will spoil as if Zack Snyder didn't already do it by making the dang thing. We are going to spoil part two of Rebel Moon for you. So be ready for that. And Caleb, there is just absolutely no way we make it through talking about this particular show without some kind of a beverage. What did you go with, sir?
Okay, so the Rebel Moon, I think, is an interesting little place that Zack Snyder has chosen to make kind of like Irish, I think.
It does seem to have a little of that in there. I'll give you that.
Did you get that? Yeah. So
I thought
I'm not going to make a cocktail today because I just want straight alcohol to deal with this. And so I poured myself some Irish whiskey. So I've got a double of Irish whiskey to start.
Lovely.
Off here. That's
I like it.
I am
drinking. I like it.
How about you?
Well, I took a moon themed cocktail, and this is quite a gory episode, part two. I'm doing what is named a Bloody Moon. It's bourbon, red wine, vermouth, pomegranate juice, and a couple of dashes of orange bitters, and you get this kind of creepy, bloody looking color to it. So I'm going with a Bloody Moon. Since
Bloody
we
moon.
End up with quite a Bloody Moon on the episode. So.
Cheers, Mark.
I cannot wait to see where we go with our discussion on this one, sir.
Down goes alcohol.
Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus, won't you shine a light?
Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show. We're entering our geek out section because Mark and I are geeks. We like to geek out, right, Mark? And even if it's something like Rebel Moon, we're going to geek out about it. But don't worry, we won't spend too long here. We'll move right on along to talk about theology and politics. So in case you're not familiar with Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon, we're talking about part two, The Scar Giver, and it is a continuation of Zack Snyder's much inferior version of any Star Wars you choose, say maybe that Star Wars Christmas special, maybe it's better than that.
Maybe.
But maybe. In this episode, we see the rebels defend their moon belt, and half of the movie, Mark, is them preparing to defend the moon, and the other half of the movie is them actually defending the moon. Mm-hmm. And so
it's a very complex storyline.
That's the summary of the movie right there. So I've given a summary of the movie. So here's my question, Mark. This is where I want to start. So there were some deaths. We discovered that the princess we all knew would be alive was still alive. I mean, you and I both predicted that at the end of the last episode. So aside from that, Mark, was anything at all narratively accomplished in this episode? Like, was there any point for this even being a movie? if we just skip this episode and went to whatever the next episode is going to be, would we have lost anything? That's my question for you to start out.
That is actually a brilliant observation. Because, I mean, you think about it, Atticus Noble, the kind of big bad, dies at the end of the last movie. And he dies at the end of this movie. So,
that's right. He's resurrected to be killed again. Yes. Ends up in the same spot.
We get the backstory of the, I'm going to call them Magnificent Seven, the people they went and recruited last time. But they all have the same freaking backstory.
Yes, that's right. They've been abused by the Empire.
No, I'm sorry, not the Empire, the Imperial, because that's different. Imperium, or whatever they're calling them, came and destroyed our village. So, yes, I'm out to get them. So that doesn't really... Gunner dies. The only change is Gunner dies, so I assume it's going to have some impact on Cora. And dang it, I just stole one of my own. Make me look stupid questions.
Yes.
I'm in trouble, man. We're only a few minutes into this, and you've managed to get me to steal my own.
Oh, now that's next level, man. That is next level. I feel pretty good about that.
Really, look, your game here.
Okay, look, so some people die because Nemesis dies too, but they could have also easily made that a part of the final battle at the end of the first movie, and and we wouldn't have even needed this movie. So I really struggled to, and I mean, I think we found out exactly how the princess died in flashback sequences, but
we get to find out how Cora's involvement and the betrayal of her adopted father.
Right. But I mean, that's also like, we're talking, I mean, the fact that we sat here for like 2 minutes trying to come up with something that needed to be there, I think says something. And the part that we could summarize it in like a sentence, I think says something about it too. So
you're exactly
right. I'm also kind of curious about this, Mark.
Yeah.
So not much narratively happened in this movie. The movie has been critically panned. I mean, we're talking like less than 20, like maybe around 20% Rotten Tomato scores. The audiences also didn't like this movie. So who exactly is Zack Snyder and Netflix? Who are they making these movies for?
Zack Snyder is making it for Zack Snyder. That's it. That is it. This is his big flex. If I have a name and I wanted to do Star Wars and they let me, so I'm going to do it anyway. And this is for me. That's for who that Netflix, I think, is almost doing it for the same reason. This whole thing felt a little like it didn't spend enough time in production. And I think they were basically rushing to get out some kind of space opera opposite of Disney releasing several Disney Star Wars things about this time of the year on their channel.
Yeah.
And so I think Netflix, this was the only thing they had in their shoot that would be kind of right up against it.
Get it out there.
They had to get it out there. That'd be my guess. I don't know. I mean, what do you think of that? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. And I think maybe the diehard Zack Snyder fans. And so, I mean, one thing you can say about Zack Snyder.
I saw a review from a Zack Snyder fan, and you could tell the poor guy you could tell he knew that he was working way too hard to try to find redeeming qualities. I'm sorry. I stepped on where you were going with that. I just had to.
No, I really wanted to know. I think maybe some of the Zack Snyder fans, because I think one thing you can say about Zack Snyder movies is that they all tend to be pretty much the same. I mean, from 300 to Watchmen to Justice League to Rebel Moon. I mean, we get the same kind of overdone action sequences, slow motion. Don't
forget Superman versus Batman. One of the worst Zack Snyder films ever.
I'm trying to forget that one. I just think that I'm not sure exactly who this is for. And yeah. I think everything from that to even the scoring. And so, Mark, you know, I like to watch closed captions while I'm watching movies. And
I don't understand you at all, man.
I gotta have them. And so one of the things that I noticed is the scoring of this movie that what I got in the closed captions was ominous music playing, foreboding music playing, rousing music, melancholy underscoring. And to me, it just underscores like the joylessness of Rebel Moon. And so I was,
but that's sort of true of Snyder movies, right?
It's kind of true. Of
he's
Snyder
all about
movies,
the
right?
dark stuff. He washes out the color to keep it dark and brooding.
Yes.
The music's always kind of dark and brooding. There's not any real character development that can lift the story.
No,
it's kind of like every character is just a piece, a plank, a piece of wood with a face painted on it.
the robot.
What's the cartoon?
I think the robot has the most range of emotion in this movie.
You give Anthony Hopkins anything, and he's going to just knock it out of the park. And I'm with you. Like, but that just shows what a bad choice of directing. I was about to make a very big blanket statement about Zack Snyder, but a bad choice of directing here is that Jimmy, the robot, the android that he plays, is sort of like the most interesting, engaging character, and we just keep him brooding off in the distance all the time, just kind of gazing at what's going on and barely being involved. And there's your selling character. Like, if you want a franchise,
Jimmy,
this is what he seems to be trying to do with all of this, is to build this new franchise. Jimmy's the way to go here, right? Is engaging.
I think so. That's right. He's actually got some kind of struggle, and like I said, the most emotional range. And I think the fact that Anthony Hopkins is in this movie, and you don't know necessarily that it's Anthony Hopkins. So I went through the cast and crew, and I'm like, wait, Anthony Hopkins was in this movie? Where was Anthony Hopkins? I feel like I missed. I'm like, oh, he's a robot that we didn't get to see. And I think it's worth noting, Mark, that we do have at least one fan of this movie, and that's Majin, who's watching live right now, who says this movie is amazing Star Wars fan fiction. And but there's like a laughing emoji. Laughing. Majin, I need to know if that's sarcasm, if you're a real fan of this movie.
I feel fairly certain.
Majin, you think it's sarcasm?
Was ribbing us a little bit. There.
Thank you, Majin, for being
very
with us.
Much so,
okay,
because
Mark,
right.
though, I it's feel funny. Like we can't get out of this segment without saying something positive about this movie. And
okay,
I think.
Yeah.
You think so? Here's what I think. The same thing that we frequently. Oh, okay. Majin's clarified. It is sarcasm. Sorry, Majin. Thanks for being with us. I thought for just a moment that maybe we'd found an actual fan of the movie. But and you're a fan of the movie, let us know.
I appreciated that, Majin. It made me laugh.
Hey, look. The cinematography's good. Some of the shots
agree.
Are beautiful.
I've heard some people bashing it, and I agree with you. Yeah. I think that there are many times where the cinematography is actually stunning, where you could freeze frame it, and that's really just is well-crafted. There's a great depth.
Yeah.
Even though he's washed out colors, there's moments where it's actually kind of beautiful the way it's been washed out. I completely agree. Can I give a but?
Yeah.
You're trying to be positive.
We're trying to keep it positive, Mark.
Sometimes the CGI was just so absolutely horrifically bad. It looked like someone at a film school who was just starting to learn CGI did it. I mean, there were moments that was very good, but there were other moments where it was like, holy moly, how did anyone say, yeah, let's go with that?
Maybe this is the rushing to production thing that you were talking about. The
score was pretty good. Score was pretty good. It really was. It was dark and brooding. But it was a pretty good score. Like it
was appropriate for the movie.
Yeah, it seemed to do the job he was looking for sure.
That's right.
I will say this: they weren't given the script nor the backstories to really develop characters. But I think most of the actors were really good at what they were given to work with. I honestly do believe that. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, it's not like they weren't given the script, but I mean, even if they were, I mean, it's not like there's any character development in the script. Like,
I mean, they literally
mad at the Imperium.
In the middle of the movie, they killed
someone important to you. Yeah.
In the middle of the movie, they literally set them around a table and say, "Hey, I got an idea. Why don't we all just go around the table and tell people about our backstory?" Like that's what you don't do. Like, if you, God, that's how he decided to try to build a backstory to what I'm calling the Magnificent Seven. Try to build the backstory.
The Magnificent Seven. I like that.
Because there were seven of them, I'm pretty sure.
There were seven. Yeah.
To build the backstory of them in a way that we really cared. Okay, so one, that's a bad way to do that. Two, you gave them the same backstory with just a little bit of change.
We could have heard one, and we could have heard, "Oh yeah, me too." That's
same. Everybody. Yep. That's the same thing. Yep. Same thing. Yep, it was my mom, not my dad. Many issues, man. So, but it was pretty at times, and the music was absolutely. I think the music was done very well, honestly.
That's right. And I'm thinking about, you know, in particular, the kind of freeze frame moments you were talking about, Mark. I think the one where they kind of zoom out and you can see kind of the planet in the background of the that's a visual image I was left with. And I think it was also some of the promotional material, but there were some really pretty things. And, you know, we're also seeing some folks commenting about how this was originally a Star Wars movie and about some of the backstory stuff. And I think that is important to point out, if you didn't catch our first episode on Rebel Moon, that this was kind of Zack Snyder's take on Star Wars, and that this was his version of it. And I think I can safely say that, you know, Mark, as critical as people have been of the Star Wars sequels, that it still feels like the right choice not to have let Zack Snyder direct any of those.
I think so. You know, for all of their faults, Lucasfilm, you know, they've made some choices that are questionable. And you and I both big Star Wars fans, and we can both admit that Lucasfilm has definitely made some questionable.
Yeah,
this one they got right when they told Zack Snyder, "This isn't for us." I think they were at least this time they were like hitting on all targets, man. They knew what they were doing when they said, "We like you, Zach. You do a lot of. You've done some big, great movies, but this one maybe not." Like, honestly. Think about him pitching a movie where the Empire, because he pitched it as a Star Wars, the Empire has out on the edges of where they rule. They have this massive empire. They have their one of their dreadnought class ships out there, and they are in such bad shape that they have to go down to a moon and basically stiff arm the residents for grain. The Empire, like the ruling, and that everything is motivated and activated off of. We need
some grain from this moon.
I would have loved to have been at that pitch meeting and watched the faces of the executives at Lucasfilm go, "I'm sorry, what? What? They need wheat?
The Empire from the moon?
Wheat?"
this one moon's going to produce enough for the Empire. Yeah. No thanks, Zach. Thanks. Go back
we're gonna pass on this one.
Your, Yeah, go continue messing up the DCEU stuff. You know, it's kind of like Quentin Tarantino pitching a Star Trek movie, just like maybe not the right feel for that. I think it's also important to say, as we're ending this segment, that Mark Mikowski has said that he knew the backstory stuff was filler. And I think it was filler in this movie. And if you are giving people backstory that's supposed to serve as their main motivation for the events of the movie, if that feels like backstory, I think that means that we've kind of missed the mark on that. Yeah, so, hey, Mark, I would love to continue complaining about this movie with you, trashing the movie with you, but or looking for some silver linings or something. But let's move on to the theology and politics. That's what we're here to do. So let's take a quick break and come back and talk about Theo Politico stuff in Rebel Moon.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining us for our Theo Politico segment. Well, Caleb, we've already mentioned that this is a pretty thin storyline. So as you might imagine, as I'm watching, realizing that I'm the person with the Theo Politico questions, I'm going, oh boy, this is going to be interesting work. So this is my
I was very glad, Mark, that you were doing that. I thought, I would talk about how crappy of a movie this is, and Mark gets to struggle for some themes in this.
So that's my way of apologizing for my long setups to these questions, because I gotta work my way to a question. So with that said, I do have long setups, so I'm gonna go ahead and ask the first one. So early in this movie, part two, we see a flashback where Cora is directed by her ruthless adopted father, the regent Balasaurus, to kill the young princess who she was charged with actually protecting. And Balasaurus makes the king watch as Cora supposedly kills the princess. And then he kills the king and the queen. And then he immediately blames Cora for killing the whole royal family. And then quickly, the dozens of people present who witnessed the whole thing follow his lead and also starts accusing her, right?
Yes, right.
What is it about that kind of leader that causes people to blindly follow? And where do you see that kind of behavior in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of times people follow others that they're afraid of and that seem unstable. And so I think Trump is the perfect example of where we've seen this. Or sometimes there's kind of a misguided notion that if people are kind of unstable, that they can also be easily manipulated. And I think that often, and by often, I mean almost never, ends up being true. And so, like, I see the Republican Party in the U.S., I think one of the reasons that they leaned into Trump was because they thought that he could be easily controlled. And that was clearly not the case. He just did whatever he wanted. He had no interest in playing politics as usual, nor did he seem to have any interest in the actual stability of the United States, like continuing to operate as a country. And so I think that's part of it. But I think that people then, once they see the unpredictable nature of that and kind of fall behind, step in line, because the person is so unpredictable. And so I think that that's the state that we now find the Republican Party in, is that they're falling behind Trump, even though he's completely unpredictable, even though he's clearly broken laws, even though he encouraged people to mount an insurrection against the country. That even Republicans who a few years ago would have said that they wanted what's best for the country, that they wanted to find some kind of way to reach across the aisle, we don't find any of that anymore. And it's because they're falling in lockstep with Trump, I think, because he's unpredictable, and they want to be on the right side if he finds himself back in power. That's my take on it. How about yours?
No, I agree with everything you said. I also just think there's just this, life is hard, and it's easy to fall into just wanting something easy. It's not the same as being lazy. It's actually an honest response to the difficulty of life, of just wanting something to just that I can just follow and buy into. And really strong, charismatic, fear-mongering leaders are easy to do that with, because it, particularly if you're a part of the surrounding group, they're frightening people, and you don't want to be the subject of their of their anger or their
drive,
trying to impact you. And so I think that's part of what's going on, and what we see even in the characters here is that there's this strong, charismatic leader who just killed off the king and queen and got his own child or adopted child to kill the princess, and then immediately flip. Like, there's some craziness there that's frightening.
Yeah,
I do think that there's a real direct comparison between the way that Trump values himself over all other people, even his own children, and is willing to throw people under the bus. And that there's a lot of folks who have a hard life who are struggling, and following a leader like that is easy. It's just, and it keeps the anger and the negativity from being focused to them. I think there's a lot more that we can unpack there, but I want to get into a few other questions. And like I said, I got long setups, so I need a little effort. After being revived from death, or at least near death, Admiral Noble tells his second in command that he wants to leave the scar on his chest that Cora made when she tried to kill him. And he says he wants to keep it to show people after he arrests her as a symbol that he is their savior. Jesus complex much? And he also, even as he's doing it, you know, he's got like, he's kind of dressed like Jesus is sometimes depicted on the cross. He's got his arms out wide, just like someone who is on a cross as this happens. So my question is, what are your thoughts on savior figures in movies that pull from Christian imagery? And then what do you think about it when it's the antagonist in the show? Ultimately, what do you think is trying to be said by Zack Snyder by doing it that?
Yeah. So I think it can be dangerous in movies when we see a kind of a savior figure. And I think it's the same thing that's dangerous in Christianity when we make Jesus into the savior who does something one time, and then we're saved for all of eternity. And I think that movies tend to do that as well. And I think a better notion of salvation is something that's ongoing and communal. And so that if we see salvation as something communal that we're doing together as a group, I think that that's a more powerful view of salvation. So I think that as a culture, we have a problematic view of what a savior is. And certainly Christianity, I think, misinterprets a lot of Jesus's message. And so I think certainly that when we see the antagonist presented in those ways, it's complicated. I think Christianity has some problematic theology, and that points that out to us in some ways. And I think sometimes that's the point, is that we're supposed to see that this view of a savior is problematic, and that sure, it could be someone who's going to do something good for us, or it could be someone who's going to do something really horrible. And I think bringing this back around to Trump again, that the religious right, I think, viewed in many ways Trump as a savior figure, even if they recognize that much of what he did wasn't religious or compatible with Christianity, that the religious right kind of put him in this on this pedestal where he was going to bring in the right Supreme Court judges and was going to get Roe v. Wade overturned, which ended up happening. And so I think now that he's like on the loose and stuff, you have to figure out how to deal with that. So I think Zack Snyder certainly seems to be, to me, pointing out this danger of a one savior kind of complex. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that the way that the that person is ultimately defeated is by people banding together and, you know, rebels on a moon who are peasant farmers finding a way to unite and kind of overcome that. So
I love that answer. And I like where you finished it. And I agree with you. And I want to use your ending about people banding together to get to one last question we're going to try to squeeze in here. So in the end, they save the moon by people not just banding together on the moon, but also people from other worlds. The Blood Axes, they come in their ships to come and kind of finish off the battle. So we see people on the planet as well as people from other worlds, from different worlds, coming together with them. Now, disregarding that it was necessary to do it with violence and that kind of thing, at least the way the story was told there, is there a lesson that we should learn from that banding together, even if we come from different worlds? Is there a lesson we should learn? And how do we go about teaching that lesson to others as well?
Yeah, I think certainly coming together despite differences is important. I mean, that's one of the values I think that we have as progressive Christians, is trying to unite together despite differences. And I think that's something that certainly we should be striving towards. But man, it can be hard too. And I think especially here in the United States, we've really been learning that lesson as we have had a harder time coming across political divides I think part of what we ought to be doing in the church and as a society is teaching each other to value one another without making blanket statements without assuming things about other people. And that's hard to do. But I think the way you do that is through relationships, through building relationships, through maintaining relationships, even when it's hard. And so I think one place that I see this as a real challenge right now is when we're thinking about what's happening in Palestine, right? You've got, say, interfaith relationships that have been maybe strong, and you see those kind of falling apart because of differences in how that situation is viewed. And so I think trying to maintain relationships while also calling out injustice, like say genocide, is something that really is tough, but is really worth doing. So I don't know that I came up with an answer for how you do that, but maybe
I think in some ways you did. I think in some ways you did. You basically were inferring that you do it by leading with example and showing that that's how to go about doing that. Once again, that's a question that we can unpack, could unpack, but we would have to take another 20 minutes to do that. But I think that's one of the things, through relationship and specifically through examples within relationships and showing folks how to go about that and how necessary it is. Our last two questions really talked about the divides and we need to figure out how do we come together and overcome the fact, yes, we all might come from different worlds, different world perspectives, but what's important is figuring out how to come together in a way that promotes the greater good rather than the good of one world or the other. And I think we see too much of that in the U.S. right now, particularly from the far right, of trying to promote the good of just one world rather than recognize the value in all of them. Yeah. We could go on and on if we had more time, but we don't have more time. And we don't want to miss out on our favorite segment, the Make Me Look Stupid segment. So we're going to take a quick drop, and we'll be back on the other side.
Welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show. Thanks for hanging out with us this whole time as we've been talking about the Rebel Moon Part 2. And Mark, I've got to say, what a wonderful job you did of finding theology and political themes in a movie where there wasn't a whole lot of story, and half the movie was literally just a battle. So I feel like I'm
glad you're impressed, because I feel like even as I was reading the questions, I was like, man, you're having to do some serious gymnastics to get to the question.
Sometimes theological content is like that, you know.
I'm
glad that we have reached this segment, the Make Me Look Stupid segment, where we can either try to make each other look stupid, or we can try and ask each other some questions that maybe we've been wondering about. And so, Mark, we do find that maybe one of the most substantial pieces of narrative that also maybe was executed poorly, but still is the time whenever we see them sitting around the table and going around their backstories. And I'm curious, did you get any Last Supper vibes from that? And if so, what theologically do you think that means?
I did get it just from the way they staged it. They literally wasn't anyone sitting on one side of the table. I guess so it makes a better camera shot. I don't know. I was like, really? You're going to be that obvious with this? You're going to go with that? I think that he might have been trying to go for that. But honestly, the fact that all the backstories were the same.
Yeah.
I guess I see it in two ways. One. Yeah. The disciples all came from different walks of life and had different backstories. And so the fact that they're all the same, I'm like, you kind of blew it. But at the same time, I guess on a really kind of more philosophical level, the disciples all had different backstories. But at the same time, while our backstories are different, our backstories are the same. We're all people who struggle to find love, struggle to find meaning. And so I guess that maybe there's a little bit there. Maybe.
You're giving him a lot of credit, Mark.
What did you see in it besides the setup?
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe I've changed my opinion about this a little bit based on your questions. I think your questions have helped me to appreciate this maybe a little bit more. I think what I ended up seeing was it was a bit communal. And so I saw that there wasn't a single savior, right? But it was a communal salvation. And so it was kind of a Last Supper, but without a single savior figure dying, like everyone being there kind of equivalent. And so certainly I think it was kind of a narrative way of landing the night before the big battle, but execution maybe left something to be desired. But I think that maybe that's,
I like that perspective. Yeah, I like that perspective quite a bit, actually. Yeah, I like that. So my question for you, you caused me to basically steal one of my questions, but as we've been going on, I've kind of remodeled it, and so I'm still going back to this. So. I know that they were planning on six of these at least. I know, we both know from the ending that they were setting up part three. I am not sure that Netflix is going to give them the opportunity to do part three, right?
Why not?
I'm probably wrong, but I'm thinking maybe. But if they were, I'm curious to know, like, when Gunner is dying, Cora says, can't I have this one thing? Like, it's like everything in her life had seemed to come together around that relationship, and she's not going to get it, and he dies. If they were to make part three, what do you think the loss of Gunner in her life will do to Cora and who she is and how she approaches everything?
Well, you know, I think The journey we're supposed to see her on is a desire to leave everything behind, that the one person she thought she could trust was this adopted dad who ended up blaming the murder of the royal family completely on her. And she then goes into hiding, wanting to live a different kind of life. And so I think Gunner is supposed to symbolize that, that otherness, that, that other life that is possible. But when he's gone, I think that that for her is that, that other type of life disappearing. And so I think in Act Three, were we to get it, we would see her just going for full force into Scargiver mode as she goes after her adoptive father. And I think that then part three is a vengeance movie where we see her going back and trying to get vengeance both for the framing of her for the death of the royal family and for the loss of this one chance she perceived she has at a kind of quote unquote normal life. That's what I think we would see in part three and what kind of impact that would have. What do you think?
I completely agree. You know, we've already pointed out that Snyder tends to repeat his story arcs just like part one and part two. And I think we would see the same story arc. Like she thought she was part of a family. She lost that family. She hardens herself. She goes to the outsides of society and becomes sort of a scoundrel of sorts. And I think we'd see her harden herself again, go to the outskirts of society. And like you said, I think that she would kind of go on a vengeance tour. I do think based on what we've seen in the story arc that we would see, whether it would be in part three or part four, like that's ever going to freaking have. But we would see her story arc come back to recognizing that she doesn't have to be an outsider and that there is the real possibility of family and having people who genuinely care about you and having a life that doesn't have to be so vengeful and all about exacting your negative feelings about the way people have been treating you. So I think that that's where he would go with it, but who knows, man, right?
And I think that I kind of hope that we don't get to find out one way or another, but
no.
Who knows? So, right. But Mark, we have made it through Rebel Moon, and I think we've found some things to talk about, and I appreciate that. But you know what makes me really glad, Mark, that we don't have to talk about it again next week.
I so agree.
So we were kind of chatting ahead of the show, and we were talking about how much we both enjoyed Fallout based on the video games. Does that sound like a good one to talk about next week?
I would love to talk. Man, it's such the antithesis of Rebel Moon. There's so much good in there. There's so much stuff to celebrate. There's so much great storyline. Yes, 100% yes.
Okay, wonderful. So next week we'll talk about Fallout. And did you ever play the game? Were you a Fallout?
You know, I never did. Yeah. It was one of the rare popular games that I never got into. It just happened during a part of my life where I was really heavily into the business world and I was so obsessed with being successful there that I had kind of walked away from video games. This show, I'm going to be going out and getting some retro consoles and playing this stuff for sure. It looks incredible.
Yeah, I'm excited. I really enjoyed the first couple of shows. I haven't watched the whole season yet, but I will.
Did you play them?
I didn't. Okay. I missed out on this, so I'm kind of bummed too because I've really enjoyed the show. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think I might go and play some too. Okay, but for now, let's make sure that we're caught up on Fallout. You've watched it all. I haven't, but if you haven't watched that, I hope that you out there listening will go and watch Fallout.
It is well worth it. We promise. It's so good.
It's going to be fun. So it's going to be the opposite of Rebel Moon. Like, yes, if you want some kind of something to compare it to, it's going to be the opposite of Rebel Moon. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to enjoy it. So we'll see you next time on the Moonshine Jesus Show. Moonshine Jesus.